This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. We're ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
The concern over immigrant children being separated from their parents on America's southern border has become an explosive political issue. It tells you a lot about the state of American politics today. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is one of those stories that's just dominated headlines all of a sudden this week, even though it's been going on for a little while, with even high-level figures like Michael Hayden, the former CIA director, tweeting a picture of the Auschwitz concentration camp, saying that America is not the first government to separate children from their parents, are basically making the claim that this is equivalent to what the Nazis have done, which a few Holocaust survivors have already come out and taken issue with.
Right.
It's one of the stories where I saw the headlines coming up earlier this week and was working on some other project and was kind of shocked at how bad they sound. But finally, when you actually start looking into a little bit, it's like, okay, well, what's actually happening? What is the U.S. immigration law? Why are these decisions being made? A very different picture starts to emerge. Because, I mean, the facts on the ground are that it is a crime to enter the United States illegally. If you're caught doing it, you're held in a detention center until you can face a trial. At that trial, a judge will decide whether you're eligible for asylum or whether you need to be deported back into your home country. In the old days, families were arrested together. But when so many families and unaccompanied children started pouring over the border around 2014, they found out that they didn't have enough family facilities to hold all of these people in. And so you had to start holding them in like normal jails or detention centers. A federal judge ruled that it was cruel to hold children in these jail-like conditions, which basically meant that the Department of Homeland Security had to take the children away, turn them over to the Department of Health and Human Services to be held in a much nicer facility. The Obama administration didn't want to do that, separate the parents from their children, so they sidestepped the issue by probably illegally just issuing an executive order that anyone who shows up at the border with a child just release into American society, tell them when their court date is, keep your fingers crossed, and hope they show up for that. When the Trump administration issued their zero tolerance policy, that means they're not supposed to release people anymore. You're supposed to hold them until their trial, and the judge gives them either a deportation order or a political asylum order. But in order to comply with this federal law that you can't hold the children in the jail-like conditions, I guess the first 3,000 families that get to the border get to stay in the family facilities. After that, the adults go to a Department of Homeland Security detention center. The children go to a Department of Health and Human Services center, which is much nicer than that. There's another law that was based in the Clinton era saying that you can't hold a child for more than 20 days, which is where things start getting a little complicated, in that if the parents plead guilty to entering the United States illegally, they can be reunited with their children lickety-split and deported back to their home country. If they file an asylum claim, so many people have done that there's a few-month backlog. So now you're in a condition where you can only hold the kids for 3 weeks, but the parents need to be held for several months till this claim can be processed, which basically means you have to release the children before you can release their parents. If at all possible, they give them to relatives in the United States. If they have no relatives in the United States, usually the Catholic Church or some other charity will put them up while their parents are waiting their asylum claim. But then if the parents are deported, you have the children in the United States, the parents in Mexico. the government's supposed to deport the children with the parents, but in maybe about 1,500 cases, the relatives they gave the children to refused to turn them back over to the government. And so you ended up in two different nations. So that's really when you're hearing them say that, like, well, parents have been permanently separated from their children. That's because immigrants brought their children to the United States. They didn't have the facilities to put them up in a way that was in compliance with the law to treat the children well enough. So they separated them into two different facilities. The parents file them an asylum claim. The government wasn't legally able to hold the children until the asylum claim was finished, so they gave the children to relatives in the United States who then refused to give them back for deportation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a whole lot here that I guess the thing that really stands out to me is just how much the left is using this as the bluntest weapon that it possibly can against the Trump administration. You have all of the comparisons with Nazis. You have Rachel Maddow on TV just crying openly because of these children being separated from their parents, as if this is, it was almost like Donald Trump himself went down there and pulled these children from their parents. But there doesn't seem to be much that really seems to be what they're interested in, is using it as a weapon, not in solving the problem. There's clearly some bad policy here that's because of all of these conflicting laws that have produced this result. And it does seem like if people worked together, they would be able to find some kind of a compromise solution in order to prevent the worst of these situations from unfolding as they are. But that doesn't seem to be what lawmakers are interested in.
Not at all. And President Trump even made up that point that he's very open to Congress passing a law to streamline or change this process so that families could be more easily kept together during this whole asylum claim process. But what he doesn't want to see happen is like what happened under the Obama administration, where he figures like, well, we can't keep the families together and comply with all these conflicting laws. Therefore, we're just going to revert to a catch and release policy.
Right.
In which case, it's well known in many parts of Mexico that if you show up on the border with a child, you're more likely to be released than if you show up on the border on your own.
So it's easy enough for a drug runner to show up with a child.
Yeah, and that has definitely happened, where drug cartels have brought children with them, or even stolen someone else's children and rented them to somebody to kind of be like a free pass into the United States.
Right.
But when you're getting this political debate, and you're increasingly seeing on the from the key officials in the Democratic Party, is they're not actually looking for Congress to pass a law saying, hey, we can keep parents and children in the same detention center. They're looking for the catch and release policy, where the laws are specifically designed that you can't comply with all of them, so you just have to have free immigration into the United States.
So with the Trump administration having made a firmer immigration policy, or enforcing immigration laws that are already in the books, such an important part of his platform running for the presidency, and so many of his supporters expecting him to, you know, exercise a certain amount of toughness in this regard, that's where the impasse is the open borders folks versus those that want to enforce the law.
Right. I mean, there's definitely room for laws to be changed or law to be streamlined, but more and more you are seeing that this is one political party that really wants to enforce illegal immigration, even making some hard decisions to stop illegal immigration, even making some hard decisions to stop that immigration. And another that wants to encourage it. And the political gridlock and the infighting and the backbiting is getting so bad that it's nothing's being done, and it's definitely favoring those who want nothing to be done. And that's something here at the Trumpet we've kind of pointed out for a long time, is that illegal immigration is a big problem in America, and was even prophesied to be a big problem in America. We've read on this show before Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52, and Deuteronomy 28, which is usually referred to as the blessings and cursings chapter. It's the blessings that come to a nation that obeys God and the curses that comes to a nation that doesn't, specifically in regards to end-time nations of Israel like America and Britain and Judah. But verse 52 of that chapter says, "And he shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down wherein you trusted. Therefore in all your land he shall besiege you in all your gates throughout the land which the Lord your God has given you." Mr. Gerald Flurry has pointed out that in his article, Where America's Race Riots Are Leading, that reference to being besieged in all your gates is a reference to trade war. But that reference to your high and fenced walls coming down is a reference to foreigners and illegal immigrants coming into America. And this is an article he wrote, I think, back around 2014, before Donald Trump was really on the scene bringing the phrase wall back into the public discourse like it is now. But they keep talking about, well, build a wall on the Mexican border, build a fence on the Mexican border. But we know, however that plays out, it's not going to solve the problem, because there's this prophecy that says, because America's disobeyed God's law, your high and fenced walls are coming down. Foreigners and illegal immigrants will pour into the nation and cause a lot of problems.
Well, thanks for that, Andrew. Europe is dealing with an immigration crisis of its own, and next week there's a major meeting planned among European leaders to deal with it. But ahead of that meeting, an interesting development. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so when you've gone trying to get 28 EU nations around in a meeting and get something done, that's almost impossible. Angela Merkel really wants to get something done at this meeting coming up. We talked last week about how the pressure is really on her to find a solution to the migrant crisis, about how she's going to face a crisis within her own government. She could potentially even lose her job if she does not find a solution to this migrant crisis in this meeting coming up in just over a week. So she really wants action to be taken. So what does Europe do? They convene a pre-meeting, but with a much smaller, much more manageable number of nations, the ones that kind of matter more on this particular crisis, get them together and try and hash out a consensus. So this weekend, there will be just 10 EU nations meeting where they're going to try and find some kind of solution to the migrant crisis that they can then try and sell to the rest of Europe at this bigger meeting later.
So you made the point, I thought it was an interesting point, you talked about this on yesterday's Trumpet Daily Radio show, just the fact that this is a really good example of how unwieldy European unification is. When they really want to get something done, they say, look, let's just leave all of the adults in the room and we'll talk about this, and they happen to whittle it down to 10 of them. It's just an interesting, to anyone who knows Bible prophecy, it's an interesting number.
Yes, you see this again and again and again. There was the so-called Berlin group 4 or 5 years ago where they were saying, okay, we want to move forward. We want some ideas for moving forward on the European Union. There were 10 nations in the Berlin group. Just a month or two ago, Emmanuel Macron was talking about, we want to move forward more closely on the military front. 10 nations signed up for that scheme. So you do see this repeatedly, that seems to be what EU leaders think about when they think about a manageable size for moving forward, or when they try to create a coalition of the willing to move forward. It's always right around that size, which, of course, well, the Bible tells us. It tells us in Revelation chapter 17 that there is going to be 10 kings that come together and give their power to this one superstate. And so when you see constantly these 10 leaders getting together, we haven't said at any point that these 10 are those kind of that final 10 that we're expecting, but you definitely see Europe moving in that direction, thinking in that direction, looking for that kind of a sized organization.
So how likely, in your view, is it that they're actually going to arrive at a viable solution?
Yeah, the trouble here, I think, is that the they are very divided in terms of what they want out of this. Angela Merkel is going into this desperate to find a way to stop migrants coming to Germany, basically. Italy is going into this trying to find how to get more migrants going to Germany. You know, they want to find a way. All of the migrants are landing in Italy. They want to get rid of them to other countries. I think the only possible consensus solution is, interestingly enough, what we just heard from Andrew, concentration camps. And we're going to talk about powers that are already building causing to be built concentration camps for migrants. Europe is the power that's doing that. Europe is handing over money to, for example, the dictator down in Sudan to build camps for him to put to arrest migrants that are on their way to Europe and lock them up in. And those ones are actually like concentration camps and very brutal. They're giving money to Libya. Libya is using that some of that money, again, to build camps so that they can stop migrants getting to the Mediterranean Sea. In Sudan's case, you know, they're working with somebody who is convicted for war crimes at The Hague. I think the only head of state in the world that's ruling, that's still in power, that's been convicted for war crimes. They're paying him to build concentration camps. So Europe loves to criticize Donald Trump, paint him as a Nazi, or literally paint him as a Nazi, as the Spiegel does on their cover all the time. That's been their solution, their kind of private solution to the migrant crisis, paying Turkey to build camps. And so you could see, well, as they move on, well, maybe they start to look at, well, can we ship some of these migrants back from Europe to Africa and set them up in some more of these camps? They're talking about, well, can we get, say, Tunisia to take on migrants? Italy is really trying to pressure these rescue boats to stop taking migrants to Italy and to drop them off at the nearest coast. And OK, fine, Libya is not declared a safe coast. Tunisia is. Take them to Tunisia. So that is, I think, the only, if they're trying to stop things, you could really see this driving Europe to get much more involved in North Africa, working with governments in North Africa and building these camps there to try and stop the migrants or send the migrants back from Europe to this region.
Well, that is very interesting that you mentioned that Europe increasing its involvement in Northern Africa. We're going to talk more about that in the second half of the program. A couple of stories about European involvement in that part of the world. So we'll table that for the time being, and we'll come back to that later on in the program. We appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. It's been a few weeks since Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un held their summit in Singapore. We'll get an update on what's been happening since from Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, actually, I'd like to go back a little bit earlier than that, to around 9 months ago, when President Trump's ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, spoke to the UN about North Korea. And she talked about the solution that China and Russia had been proposing for how to solve that conflict. And it's basically called the freeze for freeze solution. This idea essentially means that North Korea would stop testing its nuclear weapons and its missiles, and in exchange, the U.S. and South Korea would stop their joint military drills. So freeze for freeze. And here's what Ms. Haley said about it. When a rogue regime has a nuclear weapon and an intercontinental ballistic missile pointed at you, you do not take steps to lower your guard. No one would do that. We certainly won't. The idea that some have suggested, a so-called freeze for freeze, is insulting. End quote. So that was 9 months ago. Mm-hmm. But now, China and Russia, their wish for that freeze for freeze on the peninsula has basically come true. We have spoken on several recent episodes about the big June 12th meeting between U.S. President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And at that summit, they signed that agreement that said North Korea will denuclearize, but it had no timetable. It had no mention of verifiability or the fact that it should be irreversible. But despite those shortcomings and those vagaries, the U.S. has decided to go ahead and freeze its drills with South Korea. So, you know, 9 months ago, there we are saying the very idea of that is insulting, mm-hmm. but now they're frozen. So it really is clear that China and Russia have already gotten quite a lot of what they wanted on the North Korean peninsula. And then this week, Kim Jong-un just completed his third trip to China, his third trip in as many months. And he was welcomed there with full military honors. They really rolled out the red carpet for him. And this most recent visit, I think, just adds even more to the evidence showing just how influential China has been in all these developments, and showing that China is really emerging as the main beneficiary of them.
Right. What other evidence do we have of just, say, the relationship between China and North Korea being even more free and open than it had been in the past?
There have been quite a bit of developments showing that China is really positioning itself to capitalize on the North Korean economy as soon as they open it up. Just yesterday, news broke that China will be opening up a new direct aviation route from Xi'an, China, to Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. That's supposed to happen sometime in July. The Yonhap news agency broke that story, and they said, quote, China appears to be preparing for large-scale economic cooperation projects with the opening of additional aviation routes to North Korea. The move also seems intended to display the normalization of the bilateral relationship between China and North Korea to the outside world. End quote. And then this week, there were reports that no fewer than 200 Chinese companies are already in talks with North Korean companies about economic cooperation. So at present, all of those sanctions are still in place on North Korea, but it really looks like China's confident that they won't be there for much longer, and they are positioned to be ready to just take full advantage of it as soon as they come down. Or they may even be positioning to take, you know, to be able to capitalize before those sanctions are officially removed. We'll have to see what happens.
So you've written in the past about just the deplorable conditions within North Korea, and here we have a situation where the Kim Jong-un regime is being legitimized in a way that we would have probably expected that this would be bad news for the people of North Korea. At the same time, just considering the opening of economic investment, I just wonder what's your sense of what this may mean for the people of North Korea?
Well, I really can't help but feel optimistic about it in some way, just because it can't get much worse for those people. Mm-hmm. So any kind of a change could not but improve their circumstances, especially if you're talking about an economic opening up for them, besides just having, you know, more income and more economic opportunity, more opportunity to develop their potential and just explore different careers besides farming on a tiny little plot of land, which is what they're all limited to right now. Besides that, it would accompany an opening up of information. Mm-hmm. They would be able to understand the outside world, and with that, there would be more accountability on the leadership to stop, you know, treating the country like a giant prison. And so I feel like there is some cause for optimism. Mm-hmm. I'm very skeptical. I know that Kim Jong-un is one of the worst and most ruthless dictators there's ever been. But if he's willing to start to open things up a little, then maybe he genuinely wants to try to, you know, implement some reforms.
So looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, just seeing China extending its influence even more, and we'll talk about even further afield in Asia in the second segment, this really does comply with what we've been expecting.
It really does, yes. In September of last year, right around the time when those tensions were at their highest and when Ms. Haley made those statements to the UN, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry said that the world should actually not be so distracted by North Korea and should be far more alarmed by China and Russia. And he said that that's because Russia and China are really the ones that are enabling the Kim regime's belligerence and duplicity. And he explained that his analysis of that whole situation is based on Bible prophecy. I'll just read a short quote here from a letter that he wrote at that time. And it says, "The Bible's prophecies show that, in a sense, the North Korea crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely. And Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." And the prophecies that, you know, that he's referring to there are recorded in Ezekiel 38 and 39 and in Daniel and Revelation and other places. And these Bible passages show that in the end time, Russia and China will lead a very powerful Asiatic military bloc. And we have a detailed article that goes through these prophecies. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of China as a Superpower. And this article, I would just encourage anyone who wants to know more to read it. It really shows what all these tensions are leading to, and it shows the hope that's really connected to these developments that we're now seeing.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that article in the show notes for this program. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. War in Yemen has been raging for years, and it's answering what analysts are saying is the war's most decisive battle over an extremely strategic port city. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, the battle for this port, it's located on the western part of Yemen's coast, right in the Red Sea, just probably about 50 or 60 miles north of the Bab el-Mandab, an 18-mile stretch of water that separates Africa from the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. And so it's a really critical area as far as maritime trade goes. And this port city of Hodeidah has... or is currently run by the Houthis. They're the Iranian-backed Shiite group that started this civil war about 3 years ago. And this is the main conduit for arms from the Iranians to, through this port so that the Houthis can be armed. It's also one of the greatest sources of income for the Houthis, up to $40 million a month. They gain in revenue from tariffs and taxation through this port. And so... in order for the Houthi rebellion to be put down, the Saudis and the Emiratis and the others that are fighting on behalf of the government, the Yemeni government that existed before the civil war, they realize that this port needs to come under their control. And so for the past week and a half, 20,000 troops are fighting against 10,000 Houthi troops in order to try and take back this town. And so far, it looks like it's going towards the Saudi-backed coalition. They just took the Hodeidah airport over, and that resulted in about 200 deaths on the Houthi side and about 100 on the Saudi side. And now they're pushing towards the actual port. And it looks to be a bloody battle ahead. These coming probably couple of weeks, unless there's some type of peace negotiation that's worked out. Nevertheless, though, it is a very important battle that could maybe potentially see some resolution here in the Yemen civil war.
Remind us of the larger context of this. You were talking about the Houthis being an Iranian-backed group, and the Saudis obviously using this as one front in their efforts to kind of push back against the spread of Iranian hegemony through the region. If you could just remind us of that context and then where it fits in biblical prophecy.
Yeah, it's important. It is important to watch this in the larger context, just because if this port does fall to the Saudis, it's difficult to see how the Houthi rebellion could survive much longer. So I think we're going to see either two things. One, Iran really step up in the very near term its support for the Houthis to try and make sure they don't lose this port in some fashion, whether that be through more aid or more finances or more weaponry. Or if this port does fall to the Saudis, we might see Iran kind of change its tact a little bit and try and increase its support for the nations, or increase or its interference in the nations on the other side of the Red Sea. What we're looking at is Iran's desire to control this critical waterway of the Red Sea and this 18-mile stretch. That's why they're so invested in Yemen right now. The Bible also talks about other nations that are going to be allied with Iran, but they're on the other side of the Red Sea, Ethiopia, and by extension, Eritrea, and even Djibouti, which is Eritrea and Djibouti, basically right on the other side of the Bab el-Mandab. And so by the Bible, if you look at Daniel chapter 11 and verse 43, talks about Iran coming under the sway, or Ethiopia, sorry, coming under the sway of Iran. And that's basically so it can control this passageway. So I don't know how this is going to play out. I can see Iran wanting to have both sides of the Bab el-Mandab under its control, but that's the reason why they supported the Houthis in the first place, in order to control this through surface-to-air missiles and landmines, or sea mines, which they have planted, anything else to disrupt shipping. And maybe if this battle is successful, they're going to change tact a little bit, which would bring those biblical prophecies of Iran interfering in Ethiopia to light and really further that. Something that we have expected.
All right. Thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, some prophetically significant cooperation between Germany and Middle Eastern Arab states, and the attack on traditional marriage entering a new phase. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Germany is a top five exporter of arms in the world, and the latest numbers just released show that one of its main customers has strong prophetic implications. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
And so this week, the German government published its arms statistics for 2017, and one of the big... Firstly, it shows a 10% decrease in arms exports, but it is still the third highest year in record for German arms exports. So yes, it's down slightly, but only because 2016 was such a huge year as well. And what has really gotten a lot of people's attention is that Germany is exporting a lot of arms to the Middle East and a lot of arms to North Africa. This comes despite a lot of rhetoric from Germany's coalition government about cutting arms to exactly this area. The Social Democrats in particular kind of say, well, we shouldn't be selling arms to these conflict areas. Stats have come out. They showed, despite all this talk, Germany has been selling arms to those areas anyway. I thought it was really interesting. German Foreign Policy had an article on this, and they really zoomed in on those two regions as well as Asia. They basically said you can really see in this data just several specific areas that Germany is targeting with its strategic arms sales. And so they talked about Saudi Arabia and just the countries around there being one of them. There's been $4 billion of arms sales from 2008 to 2016 to Saudi Arabia, over $2 billion over the same time period to the United Arab Emirates. So lots of arms sales there. There has been a bit of a hiccup just in the last few months where Saudi Arabia is fairly annoyed at Germany because Germany's still trying to stay behind the Iran deal while America has cancelled it. But you see this much longer-term commitment from Germany to build up these nations that are opposed to Iran, and that's something German Foreign Policy draws attention to in that article. And then you also see North Africa, and especially North African navies. You're selling naval vessels to Algeria and to Egypt, and then things like border guard equipment as well to those countries, to Tunisia to a smaller extent. And German Foreign Policy in that article, again, talked about Germany having a strategy to try and build up these North African navies to make sure that they have control of that crucial North African coast.
Well, before we get into why this is so significant, seeing Germany and Europe so involved in this area, let's shift over to the next story. Another Arab state that Germany is forging connections with, Jordan. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, Chancellor Angela Merkel is actually in Jordan, or she was on Thursday, and she held meetings with the king. Jordan's suffering from a lot of social unrest right now. The prime minister was just removed, I believe it was last week or the week before. And so Germany's giving Jordan another loan of about $100 million. The chancellor announced that. This is on top of another 384 million euros, sorry, that they're already giving to Jordan each year. And so she really does see the need to support Jordan, especially in the face of Iran. She gave a press conference right next to the king, and there were some comments that she made in reference to supporting Jordan in the face of Iran, which I felt like she was quite strong about. Yeah, as Richard said, we know they've kept in the nuclear deal. They're trying to keep in the nuclear deal, but the rhetoric coming from Germany is much stronger than it has been. She said that Germany shares the concerns over Iran's ballistic missile program, its presence in Syria, as well as its role in the war in Yemen. And then she said, quote, Iran's aggressive tendencies must not only be discussed, but rather we need solutions urgently. Urgently, and just bringing the sense that we need to work on this right now. This is something that Jordan really does need to hear, just because the northern border of Jordan is borders on Syria. And right now you do have the Iranians and the Syrians pushing down towards that border to try and get rid of some of the rebel elements from that area. This area is meant to be a de-confliction zone where there isn't fighting. And yet Jordan's northern border is getting encroached upon by the Iranians, and they're worried. And so Germany's right there to say, no, we support you. Here's some extra money. We already know there's a bunch of Leopard tanks that they send as well. Germany has down to Jordan in the past. And so they have, as Richard even is mentioning, Jordan's been the beneficiary of German arms manufacturing and arms deals. And this is coming. This type of relationship is only getting stronger as Iran becomes more belligerent. And this is, again, something that we expect to take place.
Yeah, there's really quite a confluence of factors here that are driving Europe and these Arab states together. And this is absolutely something that we have talked about for a long time. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry drew attention to the prophecy in Psalm 83, I think it would have been back in the early 90s. He was talking about that. It's written up in the King of the South booklet. But seeing that we were talking in the first half about just how much the flow of migrants from the Middle East into Germany is bringing Germany into more direct cooperation with some of these Northern African nations. And here, these explicit statements by the German chancellor pointing to the threat from Iran itself, that's quite extraordinary in light of what Gerald Flurry has been writing about this.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating just even how specific Mr. Flurry has been able to get based on these Bible prophecies. I mean, if you look at, this is just an article from 4 years ago, 2013, and he wrote, North Africa is turning into a battleground with enormously important prophetic implications. And he talks about Iran moving into the area. And then he says, Iran isn't the only one interested in Africa. Germany is making strong inroads as well. Both of these powers are racing to get as much control of North Africa as they can. They will inevitably clash with each other. And there were some economic dealings with Iran. And I mean, Germany selling weapons to Algeria back then. But that's just gotten so much stronger over the last 4 years. You've had Germany have a huge military presence, or a major military presence. It's not necessarily very big, but very significant in Mali, where they're training the Malian army. They're leading the EU police force training mission. They've got a significant military presence in Mali. You've gotten generals drawing up plans for getting more involved in Libya. You've had since then German generals talking about confronting Iran across a ring of fire. So, you know, Mr. O'Flurry made those prophecies, and like you said, he's made other forecasts much earlier, and we've seen those things just come about in great detail because of these Bible prophecies and scriptures such as Daniel 11 that talks about this clash between a European power and Iranian-led radical Islam.
Gerald Flurry talked about this whirlwind strategy, linking what Europe is doing in its efforts to contain Iran. He called it a whirlwind strategy, and it seems to me like that was maybe 5 or 6 years ago that he first wrote about that. And at the time, he was looking at these various European military deployments around the Middle East and Northern Africa. And at that time, they were fairly small contingents, but we really have seen that analysis reinforced repeatedly. And what we're seeing here, it seems like it really does amplify what he was saying back those 5, 6 years ago.
Absolutely. I think one of the points that the German foreign policy piece makes that's really interesting is they said, well, actually, you could see German arms exports to this region decrease over the coming years because German arms companies have been going out and building factories in a lot of these locations,
right?
You know, working with Turkish companies to build factories in Turkey, in Saudi Arabia. So on paper, that exporting might decrease. But it's actually Germany building even stronger relationships with these countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really fascinating. Well, we'll put a link to that that article by Gerald Fleury up on the show notes for this program today. We also have a trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches, an Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe, that you can look at to learn more about that prophecy. Well, thank you both, gentlemen. We appreciate that very much. We'll go back to Asia now. China is extending its influence throughout the continent on several fronts. We'll learn now about its recent activities in the Southeast Asian nation of Cambodia. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Cambodia announced this week that China has given it yet another major injection of military aid as these two nations keep on working to deepen their ties. This announcement came just after China's defense minister spent 5 days in Cambodia, and we don't yet have all the details of the deals that were worked out there, but we know that China is providing the Royal Cambodia Armed Forces with much-needed capability boosts. And the Chinese gave around $130 million to the Cambodians toward that end. And really, this development this week is just the latest in several years of China and Cambodia drawing closer and closer to each other. Dating all the way back to 2002, Cambodia has been taking out all kinds of loans from the Chinese. At present, they total around $3 billion. And then just a few months ago, China decided to forgive almost $100 million of those debts that Cambodia owes to China. So that won them quite a lot of goodwill there. And then in 2016, Cambodia conducted its first ever joint naval drills with China. So it just really looks like the stage is being set for these two to become even more deeply integrated in defense and economic matters pretty much across the board.
Can you just put this in a little historical context for us? How remarkable is it that Cambodia and China would be doing this, and how much is this coming at America's expense?
Well, it is remarkable in some ways because Cambodia and China were bitter rivals for a while, and then for the last few decades, the U.S. has been pumping, all just vast sums of money into Cambodia, giving it all kinds of military funding, and that's been in large part for America to be able to just be better positioned to kind of contain China, mm-hmm. And so. In those ways, it is remarkable, but in another way, it's not that amazing because Cambodia is ruled by the Cambodian Communist Party. So politically, they share a lot of ideologies with the Chinese side. So there is some natural political similarities there that would make Cambodia sort of a natural partner for China. But I think it's that actually brings up a good point here, which is just that Cambodia, when they try to receive investment and aid and partnership and things like that from Western nations, the U.S. is always trying to make that aid dependent and contingent upon reforms because there's terrible human rights abuses associated with Hun Sen. He's been ruling Cambodia for about 30 years now and his ruling party. And so the U.S. always says, look, you've got to make changes. You've got to reform in these areas. Stop cracking down on the media. Stop having all of your potential political challengers eliminated, and then we'll be happy to give you more aid and things like that. But with China, Xi Jinping makes no such demands.
Right.
Xi Jinping perfectly understands a ruler who's willing to crack down on the media and wrongfully imprison domestic challengers in order to stay in power, because of course that's his modus operandi. That's what he's been doing for 5 years now. So while the U.S. and these other Western nations just sermonize to Cambodia and say, you've got to abide by the Geneva Conventions and all this, China has no such compunctions mm-hmm. or scruples. So this willingness to just kind of turn a blind eye on human rights abuses makes China's partnership very attractive to Hun Sen and Cambodia.
So really, another facet of this story of China's increasing influence within Asia and all of these neighboring countries.
Exactly. Yes. This is a trend that we're seeing happen not just in Cambodia, but several of the smaller Asian nations that have, over the last few decades, been very close to the U.S. Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, and others. These nations see America's decline. They see China growing more powerful and more willing to use its power. And so they're rapidly altering their diplomatic posturing as a result of these shifts, and they're even altering their military alignment in response to these shifts.
Where would you send people for information on how this is significant prophetically?
We have an article from our May 2017 Philadelphia Trumpet. It's called "Will America's Asian Allies Pivot to China?" And this article gets into numerous Bible prophecies, including the one in Luke 21:24 about the times of the Gentiles. And this article is just a great way to understand all of these shifts that we're seeing in Asia in their prophetic context. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes there.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. Well, the attack on traditional marriage entered a new phase this week. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
In what appears to be a first for Canada, a judge in Newfoundland has ruled that three people in a polyamorous relationship can be listed on a child's birth certificate. The relationship is two men in a relationship with the same woman. The child is obviously the woman's. They don't actually know which of those two men, if either, are the father, because there's been no paternity test. But nonetheless, because they're living together, they wanted all three listed on the birth certificate, were turned down, took it all the way up to the court system, to the Supreme Court of Newfoundland, and had a judge kind of come up with a surprise ruling that it was legal to list all three members on this birth certificate.
So it's amazing, first of all, the fact that this was illegal up until the judge decided that, well, he just wanted to do it, wasn't it?
Basically, yeah. I think there may have been one other case in Ontario where the circumstances were a little different, that where they had three people on a birth certificate, but it's definitely the first for Newfoundland. And as far as like a polyamorous couple, a first for them. And so, which is surprising for one, that there's this particular couple was just so adamant to go all the way through all these court systems to get all three people on this child's birth certificate, but also a really big blow against the traditional family, even the legal structure of the traditional family, right, in Canada, because there's been a movement for some time, and it's not necessarily the polyamorous people themselves who have been spearheading this movement. It's been a fairly powerful fraction of family law specialists that want to do away with the legal concept of marriage completely.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't think about it much, but marriage, at least civil marriage, is a legal institution as well. The marriage license gives a certain legal, makes a legal bond between husband and wife, and the birth certificate makes a legal bond between parent and child. And so it's taxed as a household, and the parent has certain legal authority over a child as far as whether they're going to be homeschooled or public schooled or what vaccines they're going to get or things like that, that they almost form a level of government below the state or provincial level, but above the individual level.
Mm. So for these people to actually get married, it's bigamy is illegal. Polygamy is illegal, but because they're not actually married, they're just living together, the judge looked at this and said, well, we can make it so that we create this legal tie between each of these three people and this child, and we're basically getting around the law that way.
Right, because there's a movement in both the U.S. and Canada to legalize polyamorous or group marriage, but its public support's at only about 15% right now, so that's probably a ways off for those who are hoping for that.
Right.
But obviously it's not illegal for these people to live together. And that is what the judge used to rule that you could list all three. Just like if you have a child out of wedlock, you could still put both parents on the birth certificate. Their judge, for some reason, was kind of, I'm not sure on the legal rationale, but ruled that because this woman was living and sleeping with both men, that you could put all three on this certificate.
So you're viewing this as really part of a concerted effort over some time to abolish marriage entirely.
Yeah, like, well, this gets back to what I was mentioning just a moment ago about the marriage union being a legal union and the parent-child union being a legal union, where they're taxed as a unit. There's certain legal rights parents have over children. And so there is definitely a group of like family law specialists who want the government to have more say over things like how a child is educated or how a child is vaccinated or how a family is taxed. And the only way to get rid of to get the government to have that most say is basically to do away with the family as a legal union. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like in the States, you've got this like this movement to do away with states' rights and give power to the federal government. Well, below the states, you have the counties, and below the counties, you have the families. So this is kind of like if you can dissolve the family right, much of that power that resides in a family structure reverts back to the federal government. Hmm. In 2001, they published a report in the Canadian Parliament called Beyond Conjugality, which basically made that same case, is that we're looking to expand the legal definition of civil marriage to include like flexible relationship contracts, like caregiver contracts. And I thought like the best way to do that is if you're looking to abolish marriage, it's kind of like it's like the logic of, well, if everybody's special, no one is, or if everyone's noble, no one is. This report, this Beyond Conjugality report, even lays that out, where they said that, well, if we can expand marriage from being a man and a woman to any two people, regardless of sex, and then expand it to group marriages of like these polyamorous trio. And then once you've got expanded it that far, you can even start looking into like marriages of convenience, where like two college roommates who want the tax break can file that. Where eventually the definition gets expanded down so far, it gets so watered down that you either do away with marriage license completely, in which case everyone's now just an individual in the eyes of the state, or you replace it with some sort of like flexible caregiver contract, or two college roommates, or a mother and son, or basically any two people living in the same building can file a form with the government to get to be taxed as a unit.
The way that you're talking about that being a kind of a power play on the part of the government in order to usurp authority that has been traditionally vested within the family is interesting. It reminds me of that article that you wrote, maybe it was a year ago, Nationalizing the Family. We can put a link to that in the show notes for the program. But it's quite a devious strategy that's being deployed here. I would also point people to our booklet, Redefining Family, which puts a lot of this, what we see here in it, the larger context of this attack on the traditional family and just how much forethought there has been, how much strategy there has been in this that's been going on for some decades. And it just seems like it's routine that we're seeing one more aspect of that being chipped away at within the legal structures within our governments, and certainly what's happening socially and in public opinion. It's quite an extraordinary trend to keep our eyes on. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all these articles, all the literature that we talked about on the program. You can email us your thoughts at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
I've enjoyed being on.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Winston Churchill. When tragedy strikes, we never think that it might be saving us from something worse. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.